Blog Talk Radio.
Healing rain is coming down. It's coming nearer to this old town. Rich and poor, weak and strong. It's bringing mercy. It won't be long. Healing rain is coming down. It's coming closer to the lost and found. Tears of joy and tears of shame are washed forever in Jesus' name.
Welcome to The Cross in the Desert, speaking hope and freedom to Iran, and good morning. Good morning to the beginning of another week here, the Monday morning edition of The Cross in the Desert, and I am here to declare to you that I am snowbound. Yes, we've had about 6 inches of snow overnight here in Florissant, Missouri, but the deep freeze and the most hardest hit areas, of course, is the East Coast, Boston. Over 7 feet of snow. Can you imagine that? I've seen pictures of people digging out little igloo-sized dwellings from their porch to where their car is parked, and they have just made a pathway through this enormous drifts of snow. But thankfully, we're not in that bad of a situation here in Missouri. However, I have been looking forward to spring for so long, and it seems so far away, well, with all of this drastic snowfall all over the country. So if you are one of those people snowbound and you have nothing else to do today, then sit back and let me talk to you today about the cross in the desert and try to make your day a little smoother for you if you are snowbound and unable to get out of your own home. It has been just an incredible 24 hours. Since I heard the news, I was at work at the bookstore, and I actually turned on my cell phone and saw that this evil, evil group, ISIS, the most evil of all groups in the world today, they have to be, has uploaded a video on a Twitter site and shown the beheading of 21 Coptic Christians who are living presently, or were living, in Syria, and they had escaped from Egypt to Syria because of the economy. They had found jobs there, and they knew that it was a very dangerous place to go, but because of their desperate situation, and these Coptic Christians, of course, fled Egypt into Syria, and thus have been captured and now gruesomely beheaded by this terrorist group known as ISIS that seems to make the news. Every day you hear something more evil they've done, the beheading of young Iraqi Christians, to the burning of a Jordanian pilot, and now they threaten to do the same thing with children in this cage. And already Egypt has struck back, bombing specific targets of ISIS, and they've done only every – what ISIS has done has enraged so many people. Jordan has struck, and now Egypt – and it seems like, even though I hear our administration is sending more money towards the cause of defeating ISIS, I don't think we've done enough. We have to do a consolidated effort to stop this evil terrorist group from what they are doing to Christians and people all over the world. As I was thinking about this, I was thinking about what the Bible has to say very specifically for us, what God says to us, Psalm 37. Verse 1, don't worry about the wicked or envy those who do wrong. For like grass, they soon fade away. Like spring flowers, they soon wither. And God is saying very clearly, I have this under control. And don't be afraid, don't fret because of evildoers. They will soon fade away. He has this under control. I know he does. And I take encouragement from God's word about this. I want us to hear this report about the beheading of the Christians right now on the cross in the desert. Let's listen.
And this is it. Even by ISIS's murderous standards, a new video the militants have just released is indeed horrific. It is a video that purports to show the beheadings of 21 Egyptian Coptic Christians. Almost as disturbing, this one purports to come not from Syria or Iraq, but from a new location, Libya. CNN correspondent Ian Lee, gathering information on the latest chilling developments, joins us now live from Cairo. Yet another depraved video, difficult to watch. The victim said to be Coptic Christians from Egypt. What have you been able to find out there, Ian?
Well, Michael, looking at this video, it's a five-minute video. It marches six men out onto the beach. The title of the video is A Message Signed with Blood to the Nation of the Cross, targeting the Coptic Christians here in Egypt. They were also talking about their brethren in Sinai as well. What this video does show, though, it shows that ISIS has firmly established itself in Libya. We had the attack in Tripoli at the Carinthia Hotel recently, and now we have this video. And this video is quite gruesome. Unlike other previous ISIS videos, this one does not cut away. It shows the beheadings, the message, an international message from the ISIS militant in the video. He is speaking in English. He is not speaking in Arabic. This is not Coptic Christians have been captured in Libya before, but this is just showing how ISIS is expanding its territorial presence. It is consolidating the land area that it has. It definitely is sending a message to Egypt here, where the Egyptian president, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, has announced that he's going to meet with his National Security Council to devise a plan to talk to them about Egypt's next step forward. But mind you, Libya is right on Europe's doorstep. That message in English also one for Europe.
Just an awful, horrible thing. I was just online chatting with my friend Shabnam, who is an Iranian-Canadian human rights activist, and I asked her how she was this morning. She said just awful that she was watching this video of these beheadings, and it's just it's so difficult to look at. And I want to give us somewhat of a perspective from the Bible about exactly what's going on here. I don't think any of us as Christians are in any doubt that the church in the Middle East is under intense, horrible persecution. Just this past summer, as we have watched what has developed in Iraq through ISIS and what they have done by scattering the Iraqi Christians, a million Iraqi Christians displaced from one of the strongest places in the Middle East. This was the early cradle civilization of Christians after the early church flourished, and of course the spread of Christianity. And ISIS comes to uproot those early Christians, generations and generations of Christians in Iraq, uprooting them from their home and causing them to become refugees. And then we saw over the summer the Yazidis being cornered on a mountaintop and by ISIS, the Yazidi population as well. And then we saw some humanitarian efforts by our government as they flew in supplies and they with airstrikes to slow down ISIS. We have seen this in the news for several months now. And many of us, of course, Christians, look at this in horror. But when we think back to the early church, when we think back to the time of the writing of, let's say, the book of Revelation, when Domitian was emperor and there was intense persecutions on Christians, I was thinking of several passages from the book of Revelation to try to put all of this in perspective to see what God has to say about the persecution of the church. Revelation chapter 6, verse number 9. When the Lamb broke the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of all who had been martyred for the word of God and for being faithful in their testimony. They shouted to the Lord and said, O sovereign Lord, holy and true, how long before you judge the people who belong to this world and avenge our blood for what they have done to us? Then a white robe was given to each of them, and they were told to rest a little longer until the full number of their brothers and sisters, their fellow servants of Jesus, who were to be martyred, had joined them. This is an interesting passage. It shows that these souls that had been martyred for being faithful to their testimony, they are crying out. This is a picture of them. They've been martyred. They're dead. They're under the altar. This is very interesting. And it says that they're crying out, Lord, how long before you judge this people that has done this to us and avenge our blood? And the answer given was just to rest. There are more to join you. They're given a white robe to rest. Now, you go further in the book of Revelation to the very end, chapter 20, and this has been interpreted, of course, as the millennial reign, whatever your specific interpretation is on the book of Revelation. We see here a scene where an angel is coming down from heaven with the key to the bottomless pit and a heavy chain, and Satan is bound for 1,000 years. And it says in verse number 4, chapter 20, verse 4, Then I saw thrones, and the people sitting on them had been given the authority to judge. And I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for their testimony about Jesus and for proclaiming the word of God. They had not worshipped the beast or his statue, nor accepted his mark on their forehead or hands. They all came to life again, and they reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. I was seized upon the wording here, beheaded, because we've heard and we've watched beheadings all summer long, all last year, and now into the new year, 2015. We're still seeing and hearing about beheadings. And in the early church and in the first century, this was the common practice for those that were Christians. The emperor wanted total allegiance. He wanted to be proclaimed as a lord, as a god. And Christians would refuse to bow to the emperor, would refuse to acknowledge him as a lord or god. They said only Jesus is Lord. And as the practice for those that would not acknowledge the emperor, the Roman emperor, as a lord or as a god or as a deity, or would not burn incense to him, and they were put to death. And in the case of these Christians, they were beheaded for keeping their faithful testimony about Jesus. And the passage says to me something very instructive as I think about these 21 faithful Coptic Christians. They are with Christ. To be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. This passage says that they were faithful, and during the millennial reign, they will worship Christ. They will be present with him. Jesus will reward them and give them much authority and power. They will reign with Christ. These Egyptian Christians will be reigning with Christ. They are faithful. They gave their lives. They refused to recant their testimony. And God will avenge their blood. If you see the book of Revelation, no matter how you interpret it, you know one thing is for sure. The church wins in the end. The church, the Bible says, the gates of hell cannot prevail against the church, because it's built on a solid foundation of Christ. And so what we see here in the book of Revelation is those that are faithful, that have kept their testimony, that have refused to worship the beast or take his mark, and they are rewarded and welcomed by Christ, and they reign with him forever and ever. And so in the end, their blood has been avenged through the mighty acts of God's wrath. In the end, God has vindicated their faithfulness. And it says here in the book of Revelation that when they cry out and ask, how long, O Lord, they are told to rest. There's many more martyrs to come. They are given a white robe, which symbolizes the purity of the Lamb, the righteousness of the Lamb. And it's, again, showing us as Christians, when we are faithful, God rewards us. We are in his presence forever. We reign with him forever, and God will certainly avenge their blood. Remember what I opened the program reading. Don't fret because of the evildoers, because God will cause them to fade away. God will deal with them. And he has not forgotten their suffering. He has not forgotten their faithfulness. And so I wanted to share this with you this morning. I know if you're like me, you're looking at the atrocities of this evil group and wondering what is the perspective of God's word on this. And it's very clear that he will avenge their blood. He will vindicate their faithfulness. They will rule and reign with Christ for 1,000 years. They are with him. And no more evil can touch their lives. No more harm can come to them. And God will use the many nations as his sword of judgment against this group, against this evil, evil plague. But as we look at the book of Revelation and think of the early church and we see the persecution and suffering, we know that God uses this evil and persecution to cause his church to grow, his kingdom to grow all over the world. And we can see through history how God has used the suffering of martyrs to cause the expansion and growth of his church. There's no stopping the church. Jesus says, upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. Well, other things that are happening in the news, I remember last week on the Thursday program, I talked about the unfortunate, tragic shooting of the three Muslims at Chapel Hill, cause of me writing my newest blog. And I want to share that with you in a few moments, but I also want to take us to a statement by one of the friends of the victims. Yusur was her name. And this is a young girl who had something to say about their life, about what they stood for. And here's what she had to say. We're going to listen to it right now on the cross in the desert. Let's listen.
I spoke to her a few weeks ago, and I was just asking her about how's married life and the relocation to Chapel Hill. And, you know, she was saying that they were having trouble with this neighbor, and that she said the exact words, he hates us for what we are, and that he had come up to their house and, like, kind of flashed that he had a gun on his waist because apparently they were being too loud and woke up his wife or something like that. They lost the three most amazing people you could ever imagine knowing. Like, I can't even describe who they are and what they represented because you can only feel it. Like, you'd feel how they united everybody when you were around them. Even now, that's what they're still doing. Like, thousands of people are gathering to commemorate them, and their charity is ongoing and tenfold. I think a lot of good is coming from this. It's tragic and it's horrible, and I can't even express how it feels to hear that your three friends have been executed. But we're the ones that aren't lost. I know that they're in the highest places in heaven, and we're the ones that are going to have to suffer their absence, because you will feel their absence because of the impression that they made on everybody around them. The only result anybody wants to see from this is good acts, and I think that's proven with over $100,000 being raised to help other people. That was their mission, that was what they lived for, and that's what we're going to continue to do for them.
I guess the best way to respond to this young friend of the shooting victims is to think of, if you have a good friend or friends that you admire and look up to, and one day in your normal routine, you heard they were tragically executed, how would you feel? And you would probably have many, many wonderful things to share with your friends about them if the media would stop you and ask you. And I guess I can think of that when I think of this young girl. Yusur and Dia and Rizan were very committed Muslims, and from what I have learned just by reading about them, they were very charitable. They wanted to help the suffering Syrian people, and especially Dia had planned a summer trip to go there and help them with free dental care. And his new bride, Yusur, who they had just been married a month, and they were going to travel. That was their plans. They were going to travel into Turkey and to help them with free dental care, which is a wonderful contribution to people who are suffering and people who are in need. And so what I have learned just by reading their stories is that they cared about suffering humanity. And these were beautiful Muslim people, apparently very peaceful people, attending school, trying to make a difference in our world. When I heard about this, I immediately was shocked and horrified. And all of you that join me on a daily basis on the cross in the desert, you know what I do. I speak up for the Iranians and the human rights violations and their suffering. And some of them are Muslim. Not all of them are, but some of them are Muslim. Some of them are still proud of their heritage. And I also speak up for many of the Muslims in Malaysia and other parts of the world. I share my books with many of them. I have friends at work who are Muslims. I have friends on the internet who are Muslims. And we talk and pray for one another. And I share with them what I do in a respectful way. And so when I heard about this tragedy, it made me immediately think about my purpose here. And my purpose here is always to reach out with the Muslims in a respectful way and to stand up for their human rights if they live in Iran and other parts of the world. And when I heard about this tragedy, it reminded me long ago of a book I had written. Oh, about 3 or almost 4 years ago, I started writing this book. It's called Tears in a Bottle, Seeing Through Their Eyes. And I want to explain to you some of the reasons why I wrote it. It was at the time, right after the big mosque controversy in New York, where a Muslim group wanted to build a mosque near the site of the World Trade Center Memorial. And this battle goes on back and forth. And I thought about this, and I thought, this is a great storyline. I want to talk about this because lots of times Muslims are victims of what the media talks about them in. A lot of times many of us have the common notion that every Muslim is a terrorist. And I wanted to deal with that media stereotype. I wanted to deal with that situation that was going on in New York. And so I wrote a book called Tears in a Bottle, Seeing Through Their Eyes. In other words, what's it like to be a Muslim in today's world when you're constantly being compared to every terrorist act, every group in the world? How do you live with that stigma on you? Now, I was doing it not to be soft on Islam, not because I'm somehow trying to, you know, downplay the teachings of Islam, that it's somehow compatible with my Christian faith, not at all. I was simply trying to say, look, what is the best approach we can have as Christians to Muslims? And I thought the best way is to show them our love and friendship. Instead of being afraid of your Muslim friend next door, instead of building walls of fear and staying away from them, we should be the greatest example of who Christians are, showing them our love and our respect. And that was the impetus for writing Tears in a Bottle. I had these two characters. One was Esther, coming from Iran, and this was from the book Shining Star. It was a sequel to that. Esther and her husband leaves Iran with their child and comes to New York to start a new life. They've left Iran with all of the trouble and the oppression. They've come here for a new life. And the character in my book, Esther, had a very troubled marriage. Her husband was very abusive. And here she has this 10-year-old son named Amir. And they come here with new high hopes that somehow their life will be better. And instead, they come here in New York at the time of the mosque controversy. And so there's a lot of discrimination and hatred going on. And Esther feels just like she's in prison again, living here in the United States, the way she's being treated and stereotyped. But along comes this young Christian woman that she meets one day in Central Park. Her name is Ariel. Ariel is a painter. She's painting everything she sees. And Esther and Ariel meet in Central Park, and the rest of the book is a chronicle of their friendship, their unconditional love to one another, with no pressure of converting one another, just a real special friendship. Now, there are things they talk about. Ariel talks about her Christian faith. Esther talks about her Muslim faith. But it is a book that brings these two groups together, these two religions, if you will, Islam and Christianity, and shows possibilities of what can happen when a Christian reaches out to a Muslim and stops building walls of fear, but just reaches out and shows them their love and friendship without any strings attached. And so that was the basis of the book, Tears in a Bottle, Seeing Through Their Eyes. And I wrote it with that in mind. And when I heard of this tragedy this past Thursday, I thought of my book and the possibilities of Christians who read this book and others that read this book to see how we should treat our Muslim neighbors. Obviously, in the case of Dia and Yusor and Razan, their neighbor, treated them on a whole different level. He was afraid of them. He apparently hated them. And now it's being taught or told and being implied that what he did was a hate crime. I want to bring us an interview recently done with a spokesman for the family about this charge of hate crime. And let's see what you think as you hear this report, and we'll come back and talk about it right here on The Cross in the Desert. Let's listen right now.
Well, one of the major issues surrounding this story surrounds the question of whether the shooting was simply over a parking dispute or, as Manny mentioned, was religion a factor. A Facebook profile bearing Craig Hicks' name and photo paints a portrait of a vehement atheist who shared anti-Muslim and anti-Christian posts and links. Also, the fact that all three victims were shot in the head execution style is leading many to believe that this was, in fact, a hate crime. To provide more insight on this story, I spoke earlier with Linda Sarsour, a spokesperson for the family, and I began by asking her if the family is convinced that this was, in fact, a hate crime. So, Linda, is the family convinced that this was a hate crime?
Yes, the family is absolutely convinced that this is a hate crime based on conversations that the father had with his daughter about a very hateful neighbor. She told her father, "I know that he hates me for who I am and for what I'm wearing." He used to see them walking into the apartment complex and have his hand on a very visible gun in a holster. And that plus interesting social media posts. It seems he's a very extremist anti-theist, so he's very anti any religion or anti-religious people.
I want to play a soundbite of Hicks' wife and what she told the media yesterday. Let's play that.
"I can't say with my absolute belief that this incident had nothing to do with religion or victim's faith, but in fact was related to the long-standing parking disputes that my husband had with the neighbors. And our neighbors are various religions, races, and creeds."
She says it has nothing to do with religion, and yet the fact that these three young people were gunned down, execution style, all shot in the head, does not seem to necessarily correlate with the idea of a crime of passion over a parking issue. Am I wrong?
It's actually quite offensive when you're telling families that their three children were murdered execution style, pronounced dead on the scene over a parking space. You have to have a lot of hate in your heart for you to be able to murder young students in the way that they were murdered.
There's been a remarkable show of support, certainly, on the UNC campus. Thousands of friends, relatives, strangers packing the central campus plaza known as the Pit for a vigil last night. What kind of support has the family been receiving from the community?
The family has been receiving an outpouring of support from every corner of this country, from people of all religious backgrounds, students, clergy. We've had companies reaching out to us, people who wanting to create donation pages, young people who are putting together events to raise money for Syrian refugees, just as Diyat Berekat, one of the victims, that was kind of his thing. He was spending a lot of time and energy raising money for refugees and to go on a trip actually to Turkey to work with refugees. So the support has been immense, and it just shows the hope and the potential of us as a country to unite against hate.
How does the family feel about the way this story is being covered in the media? For instance, if we were to reverse the situation, it was a Muslim man who shot three white college students. How do you think the coverage would play out? Would it be any different than what we're seeing?
Absolutely. I mean, as soon as the incident happened, you had three dead college students. Regardless of what their race was, there should have been media coverage. And there was no media coverage until people went on social media and raised their voices, tagging all the mainstream media outlets, until there was really a buzz about this. And like you said, if the perpetrator was Muslim, we would be having nonstop coverage of his religion, who he's affiliated with, who, where did he work, who did he speak to. And there really hasn't been that much focus. I'm happy that the focus now has been on these three lives, on their beautiful lives, full lives that they've lived, on their families. And that's the story you want to tell, because these were Americans, but not only were they Americans, they were extraordinary Americans who gave back to their community, were successful students, and that's how their families want them to be remembered.
If the situation were reversed, would this be called an act of terrorism? Do you believe that in this case it should be called an act of terrorism?
It's absolutely an act of terrorism. Terrorism is a crime that has political or religious motivations behind it. This guy was an anti-theist. If you look at some of his social media posts, he was anti-religion, anti-religious people. These young women were wearing headscarves. They were identifiably Muslim. And we should be calling domestic terrorism, regardless of who the perpetrator is or who the victims are. And in this case, this absolutely, to me, is a domestic terrorism case.
Well, certainly our condolences to the family. Family spokesperson Linda Sarsour, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
I remember last week when the story initially broke. I work at a hospital here locally, and I have a Muslim friend. Her name is Mene, and she comes from Morocco. She works in the food service department, and we pass each other quite a bit, either on the elevator or the ground floor. And when I saw Mene and dressed in her traditional hijab, I walked up to Mene. I said, "I'm really sorry, Mene, for the horrible tragedy that I'm sure the Muslim community is suffering with." And she just looked at me like, you know, wow, I don't know what to say. She said, "Thank you." I said, "You know, it's just horrible." She says, "You know, I know this is not because of a parking dispute. Thing more going on here. I really feel there's more to it than that." And I agreed. And so what we heard in that report is that the family looks upon this as a hate crime. And of course, there has to be evidence of that. But what they're saying is, look, you don't walk into someone's living room and shoot them each in the head over just a parking dispute. And I can see their point of view. It seems more like an execution than just simply a dispute or a heated argument over parking situations. And then when you take all of the other evidence about what his Facebook page purportedly said, and then you take the evidence of when he actually went up to their home and talked to Yusur, and he's wielding this gun in his belt, this antagonistic situation really didn't happen until after Dia became a married man. Until Dia and Yusur were married, it seemed like that when this man would see the women wearing hijabs coming in and out of the house now, it just perpetuated more of his fear and anger. At least that's what the story is saying to us as we read it. And it seems like that this perpetuated more and more of this anti-religious fervor going on in his heart. And so it seems to me, just from what evidence I have now and before me and the stories of the family, it seems very likely that this could have been much more than a parking situation, that it seems to be perpetuated from a personal antagonistic toward Muslims. It seems like a hate crime is something that should be investigated very thoroughly in the case of these three beautiful Muslims. Well, we could debate and discuss this ad nauseum infinitum, but what I want to do is I want to talk about the blog I just wrote about this tragedy. I want to speak to you from the heart about this, because what's going on here is a common problem amongst many people, and it's called building walls of fear. And when I heard about this tragedy, I thought about what happened, and I thought about my many Muslim friends all over the world and their situation and their sadness and grief over this. I knew I had to write something about this. I knew I had to speak out in their behalf like I did in the book Tears in a Bottle. And so over the weekend, I sat down with my quiet time and just put together my thoughts. And what I want to do is I want to share with you what I wrote on my latest blog. And so as I read it to you, I want you to kind of think about the issue here and think about the Muslims that were slain and killed. And think about what all of this represents and how do I make sense out of this. This is what I wrote in my latest blog. It's entitled, "Your Next Door Neighbor is a Muslim." Love the Lord your God with all of your heart and with all of your soul and with all of your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment, and the second is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. Matthew chapter 22, verses 34 through 40. During his earthly ministry, Jesus was asked by the elite religious leaders, what was the greatest commandment? They often asked Jesus questions not because they were interested in pleasing God, but rather to test and discredit him before the masses of people. However, Jesus knew the motives of their hearts, and was quick to silence their deceitfulness. But they never gave up, and in Matthew's gospel, once again, the Pharisees and scribes, Jesus to the test. Quote, hearing that Jesus had silenced the Sadducees, the Pharisees got together. One of them, an expert in the law, tested him with this question, quote, teacher, which is the greatest commandment in the law? Jesus replied, love the Lord your God with all of your heart and with all of your soul and with all of your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment, and the second is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. All the law and the prophets hang on these two commandments. Jesus gave a masterful answer to their question. He pointed out that the ultimate way to please God is to love him with our whole being, core of what it means to be a Christian. It is the identifying mark of a genuine faith. But notice what Jesus added. If we claim to love God, then it must also be evident in the way that we treat others. Jesus points out that, quote, loving God is not an isolated act, but a visible one. And if we claim to love him, then it will be evident in the way we treat our neighbor. Dia Berkat and Yusr Abi Salah were newlyweds. They had only been married for little over a month. Dia was a vibrant, bright, intelligent, and energetic student in his second year of dental school at the University of North Carolina. Yusr had planned to begin her dental studies in the fall. They were both busily engaged in raising money for a trip this summer to provide dental care for the suffering Syrian people in Turkey. Dia and Yusr were both dedicated Muslims committed to bringing compassion and relief to the suffering masses of humanity. Razan Abu, Yusr's sister, had recently been recognized by the university for her artistic endeavor in abstract model making. Dia, Yusr, and Razan were three young and beautiful Muslims in the prime of their lives, studying hard to make a difference in the world. And in just a few terrifying seconds, their hopes and dreams were shattered by an angry, out-of-control neighbor, Craig Stephen Hicks, who shot them each in the head in a rage execution over an alleged parking dispute. I have a live weekly blog talk radio and program entitled The Cross in the Desert, Speaking Hope and Freedom to Iran. My radio program is dedicated to making listeners aware what life is like for my dear Iranian friends behind the Iron Curtain of the Islamic Republic. The Islamic regime is cruel and harsh to the Muslims living in Iran and torture them in prison if they dare to disagree and speak out against the many human rights violations. A voice of hope for my Muslim friends, I am also an author of Christian novels. 3 years ago, I wrote a book called Tears in a Bottle, Seeing Through Their Eyes. Tears in a Bottle is the story of an abused Muslim woman named Esther, who moves to New York City with her husband and child during the heated controversy over building a mosque near the World Trade Center Memorial. Struggling to overcome the hatred from non-Muslims, and fighting to stay alive in an abusive marriage, Esther is desperate and hopeless until she meets Ariel, a Christian woman, one day in Central Park, and her life is transformed forever. I wrote Tears in a Bottle to point out that not every Muslim is a terrorist. Muslims are human beings just like you and me with hurts and fears and struggles that need our love and compassion instead of our hatred and judgment. My book focuses in on how a simple friendship, a listening ear, a caring heart can bring hope to a troubled life. Ariel took the time to listen to Esther's problems and invested her time and energy into her life, even though they both came from two distinct religious backgrounds. They both agreed to love each other unconditionally. When I heard the tragic news of the three Muslims from Chapel Hill being executed by an angry neighbor, I was heartbroken. I immediately thought about my book and remembered the reason why I wrote it. I dedicated my radio program to Dia, Yusor, and Razan, and prayed for God to bring comfort and healing to their families. Jesus taught that if we really love God, then we must demonstrate that in the way we treat our neighbors. Craig Hicks was a neighbor to Dia and Yusor. Yusor was terrified of Craig, telling her father that he showed up on her doorstep with a gun in his belt, arguing about parking spaces. She was convinced that he didn't like them because they were Muslims. What about you? Are your next-door neighbors Muslims? Just a cursory reading through the gospel, and it becomes obvious how Jesus treated people. He was never judgmental, but instead compassionate and respectful to every person from every walk of life, from the fisherman to the tax collector, the highest nobility, and even to the lowest prostitute. Jesus lived by what he taught. He loved his neighbor. He was motivated by love and compassion. However, the opposite is true when we are motivated by fear and suspicion, when our hearts are ruled by the stereotypes caused by the media, that Muslims are no different than the members of ISIS, that instead of getting to know our neighbors, we erect walls of fear and hatred that make friendship impossible. I have many Muslim friends on Facebook in Iran and Malaysia, and even here in the United States. We chat together, pray together, and sometimes even cry together. At the hospital where I work, I have a very good Muslim friend. Her name is Manny. She is from Morocco. Every time that I see her, she greets me with a smile and wants to know how my day is and how my wife is doing. If I'm having a stressful day, I'm 100% better after I've talked with Manny. My stress is gone. Manny is the perfect example of a real human being, a very peaceful Muslim who has nothing to do with terrorism or ISIS. She is my friend and my neighbor. I didn't approach her with stereotypes or suspicions. I didn't build a wall of fear. Instead, I got to know her, and she was one of my best friends at work. Tears in a Bottle is a book about friendship. Friendships between Muslims and Christians. The title of my book is based on a precious little verse in the book of Psalms. Psalm 56, verse 8, says of God, quote, "You keep track of all of my sorrows. You have collected all of my tears in your bottle. You have recorded each one in your book." God cares about all of our tears and hurts and pains. He understands our suffering extremely well because he experienced it firsthand. Jesus bore all of our guilt and shame when he died on the cross. In his suffering and death, he removed it. He took it out of the way so that we could have a real love relationship with God. In my radio tribute to Dia, Yusor, and Razan, I mentioned this verse and talked about how God uniquely understands our suffering in pain. God is not a faraway, distant deity in the midst of our pain. He is an ever-present help in our time of need. The Bible teaches that he is close to us in our brokenness. Psalm 34, verse 18 declares, "The Lord is close to the brokenhearted. He rescues those whose spirits are crushed." I prayed for the families of the slain Muslims, that they would feel the love and comfort of God, that they would sense his presence and recognize that he is there in their midst, right with them in the midst of their grief and sorrow. We need to stop building walls between ourselves and our Muslim neighbors. We need to stop allowing the media to distort the picture of who they really are. Most Muslims are peaceful, law-abiding citizens who deserve our love and respect instead of our fear and judgment. One neighbor allowed the media, his fears, his hatred, and anger to control his heart, and as a result, three Muslims became his victims instead of his friends. Jesus taught us to love our neighbors as we love ourselves. What? I guess that's the only way I can respond to this tragedy is to share with you from my heart, my book, my feelings, my convictions. I have found that the way we get to know Muslims is not through reading books in a bookstore. There are some books that are instructive about the history. There are some books that are helpful if we have a real debate with certain Muslims that we need to talk about those issues. But for the most part, I find that reading books just does not help us to understand Muslims. We understand them by becoming neighbors to them, by becoming interested in their life, by becoming involved in some way. However the Lord leads you, He will lead you. But I have found that kindness and respect and love goes a long way instead of fear and suspicion and judgment. And so I don't mean to sound preachy to you or trying to lecture you today. That is not my purpose. It's just sharing to you from my heart that the way we talk to all people, and the subject is about Muslims, so I'm talking about Muslims, the way we talk to Muslims is with our kindness, our love, and our respect, that our life needs to be a demonstration of who we are as Christians. And so if you have a Muslim who is your next-door neighbor that maybe you struggle with this issue and you're a little bit afraid and a little bit suspicious, take the opportunity to break down the barriers. Those walls we have created, we are the only ones that can break them down. And I had a professor when I was at seminary that talked extensively. His name was Jerem Bars. I went to Covenant Theological Seminary. He talked about the way we treat non-Christians. And one of the illustrations that he used constantly was the fact that we build walls and make friendship and communication impossible. We build walls of fear or suspicion. And we need to stop building walls and reaching out. Because the only way we're going to make a difference in the lives of those that aren't Christians is to show our unconditional love. And we do that through reaching out to them and not allowing the media and not allowing what we've heard to shape our thinking. And this is a prime time, I think, right now for us as Christians to reach out to Muslims, to be their friend, to show them that as Christians we don't judge you and this is our feelings towards you. And we can ask lots of good questions. We can talk together over dinner or whatever the situation is. We can invite our Muslim friends to a barbecue. Just no pork, okay, or alcohol. But we invite them. We get to know them. And this is the best way that we break down the stereotypes and the barriers. My book, Tears in a Bottle, is just about that. There is one scene in the book where Ariel and Esther are riding together. Esther is riding with Ariel. She invited her to go on a picnic, and she's going to take her to the place where she used to live, and this is where her husband is buried, and they're going to go to this place, have a picnic. And in the midst of Ariel driving, Esther stops and just says, "Why are you doing this for me? Why are you treating me this way? Why are you showing me this kindness, Ariel? Is there a motive? Is there another agenda going on here?" And so right then and there in the car, Ariel deals with the idea that Esther has that she's only being friends with me so that she can try to convert me. And Ariel, I write about this in the book, Ariel deals very well with this objection. I wrote that in the book because sometimes, our friends, non-Christian friends, be it Muslim or whoever they are, may look at us and try to say, "What is the real reason you want to be my friend?" And so this is a great opportunity where I deal with that objection of unconditional love and friendship in the book. And you just have to read it to hear what Ariel says. I don't want to spoil it for you. But I'm not trying to exploit this tragedy by selling books. Please don't misunderstand me. I'm only referring to my book because I feel that this is an important book to read at a time like this, especially in light of this tragedy, because it brings us back to us being a true neighbor, as Jesus taught, a true loving neighbor to our Muslim friends. And so I'm doing that for that reason and for that reason alone. But what we need to do right now in a practical way, we need to pray for this family, for this community, for the incredible sorrow and grief they're feeling, and pray that God will use this tragedy in some way, bring some kind of beauty out of the ashes of their suffering. And I hope that this helps you in some way if you have Muslim friends, or if one day the Lord brings a Muslim into your life, that this will help you in a practical way on how to talk to them, how to treat them, how to reach out to them as a Christian. And I think we've all learned something from this horrible tragedy. Isn't it a shame that we have to learn valuable lessons from horrible tragedies? But in this case, I hope we've learned the lesson of what Jesus taught us, to love our neighbor as we love ourselves, to stop building those walls of fear and suspicion, especially if our neighbors are Muslim neighbors. Okay? What I want to do now, I want to kind of change subject matter for you. And I want to go into what the Cross in the Desert, of course, is all about. It says, speaking hope and freedom to Iran. If you follow my program, you probably heard a couple of weeks ago, I talked about February 1st is a pivotal day in Iranian history. February 1st is when the Ayatollah Khomeini arrived back from Paris into Iran to assume the leadership after the Shah has been exiled and gone, and who is greeted by millions of those revolutionaries waiting for his arrival. Well, just a few days ago, February 11th, I think to be exact, the Iranian regime celebrated 36 years of the Islamic Republic. 36 years. Last year, I wrote a book called Chasing After Rainbows, Stories of the Revolution, and my book was about a human rights activist who helps her best friend who's on death row in Tehran. He tries to help her get free from the death penalty there. But the story is about their friendship growing up during the Iranian Revolution. It's the characters of Shabnam and Sahar. And my book, Chasing After Rainbows, was dedicated to my two good friends, Shabnam Esadli and Shadi Paveh, both Iranians who had grown up during the revolution and now were prominent human rights activists. And so I wrote in the foreword about them. When I think back now to 36 years, what has the Iranian regime done for the Iranian people? This was an amazing historical event. Many of the millions of Iranians that welcomed Khomeini thought, this is our freedom, this is our hope. And what did cause more death, destruction, and bondage? And the rest is history. You can look and see what happened as a result of the Iranian Revolution. What we have today in Iran, the continuing executions, the imprisonment of journalists and lawyers and those that dare to speak a word of disagreement with the Iranian regime, they are put to death. Christians are put to death. Muslims who become Christians are put to death. So what has really changed? The Iranian regime of 36 years have brought more death, destruction, and bondage to the Iranian people. And we can see from history what has happened since the Ayatollah Khomeini stepped off that plane in February of 1979. We look back 36 years. Now, they had this big celebration for 10 days in Iran about this glorious revolution and what it's accomplished. But if you're like one of my Iranian friends, you can see what it's accomplished. Fear, oppression, death, economic woes, unbelievable economic woes. And the thing that is so amazing about this is that we are sitting down with the Iranian government to negotiate a nuclear deal instead of human rights. We are talking about helping a nation to secure a nuclear weapon so they can launch them against their foes all over the world, especially Israel and, of course, the United States. Just a few months ago, my good friend Shabnam had an interview about this very topic, and she wrote some very interesting things that I want to try to read to you if I can get it there, because my computer is now playing little bits of jokes on me when I switch the pages. It does that. It kind of sticks on me. So what I want to do is try to read a little bit of that interview to you, because I think it's insightful that what Shabnam says to Kaveh Tahiri, who interviewed her. This is from the Gatestone Institute. And talking about the human rights situation, the nuclear rights situation, Kaveh asked Shabnam, my good friend, in what ways do you feel that the international community and the West could facilitate improvement of the human rights situation in Iran? Now think with me, we've had 36 years of the Iranian regime, and what have they done? But Shabnam had a very good answer to his question, and this is dealing with the nuclear negotiations that's going on and what's happening right now. Here's what Shabnam said. After Rouhani became president of Iran, the U.S. administration of President Obama and the EU, under the pretext of diplomacy, took advantage of just engaging in negotiations to bring economic advantages to all three parties. The U.S. and private Western businesses, as well as the regime of Iran, took advantage of sanctions loosened by the U.S. to sell to the fresh open market. And Iran, absolved of sanctions, kept developing the nuclear program and increasing centrifuges, as well as receiving billions of dollars. As for the West, when the Iranian regime accelerated its nuclear program, people went the usual route, from being concerned to being indifferent to being complicit. The U.S. did not bring up the issue of human rights or even releasing innocent prisoners. And of course, Shabnam is referring to Amir Hikmati, Saad Abedini. The West seems so desperately eager to give Iran nuclear capability, perhaps from the pressure of business lobbies and perhaps out of Obama's panic-stricken need for a legacy. What Obama does not realize is that if he does let Iran acquire nuclear capability, his legacy will be just like that of Britain's Neville Chamberlain, a laughingstock who held up a piece of paper he thought assured peace with Hitler. The U.S. and the West should not accept on shutting down Iran's nuclear weapons program. It should not allow Iran any opportunity to blackmail the West into a compromise on the pretext of Iran helping to fight the Islamic State. The United States Secretary of State John Kerry cordially invited Iran to play a role in arresting the momentum of ISIS in Iraq and Syria. There is a role for nearly every country in the world in turning back the militants and debunking their ideology, including Iran, he said. But Iran's leaders, who are Shiite, would be happy to fight ISIS, who are Sunni anyway, or even better, let the West fight ISIS for them. If Iran's regime, with its open record of duplicity, continues to be appeased by the Obama administration and the P5 plus one, any deal will only destabilize the Middle East and the West, as country after country will feel obligated to acquire nuclear weapons. Ironically, Iran's nuclear weapons would also be used to strengthen the very terrorist jihadist groups Iran has been funding all along, the ones the West is supposedly trying to counter. And if Iran is able to have nuclear-tipped missiles pointed at Berlin, Paris, and London, it would not even have to use them. The threat would be enough. This is disastrous, and Shabnam Assadli points this out. Why are we sitting down appeasing a terrorist government like Iran? It's so sad. It's almost mind-boggling when you think about what is going on there. Well, there is also something else inflaming Iran's passions about what they want to do if they acquire a nuclear weapon. And just a few years ago, an author, Reza Khalili, who is actually an ex-CIA spy, he was part of the Revolutionary Guard in Iran, and he left, became a Christian. He's been working with Homeland Security, and he's also been working with the CIA, a little bit of counterintelligence. Reza Khalili wrote a book called A Time of Betrayal, in which he chronicled what is going on in Iran and why they want a nuclear weapon and what their actual religious beliefs are and what they're up to. He had an interesting conversation with Pat Robertson on the 700 Club just a few years ago. I want you to hear this in the context of what Iran plans to do, what their beliefs are. We're going to listen to that interview right now on The Cross in the Desert.
Almost 200 executions were carried out in Iran this year, 26 during the month of March alone, and last year that figure was as high as 740.
Well, folks, welcome to the 700 Club. You wouldn't believe it, but it's true. CBN News brought you an exclusive report about a video produced by the Iranian government. The video claims that the Islamic Messiah, the Mahdi, will soon appear. And that story has caused problems within the Iranian government.
It's amazing, Pat, because actually at the same time, followers of Iran's supreme leader are showing their support for the video and the Mahdi. Here's Eric Stackelback with that story.
The Iranian video, first seen on CBN News, is called The Coming Is Near. It says the current unrest in the Middle East is a divine signal that Iran will soon help usher in the end of days and the return of the Islamic Messiah, also known as the 12th Imam or Mahdi.
The video labels Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, as the mythical figure who will pave the way for the Mahdi's return. It was never intended to be seen by a Western audience, and now the Iranian regime is in damage control mode.
Iranian media reports say the producer of The Coming Is Near, seen here, was arrested after revealing that Khamenei and Iran's president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, had approved the film. And some Iranian observers say the recent firing of Ahmadinejad's chief of staff came after he was linked to the film's production.
Those opposing Ahmadinejad are using this to attack him. And then other radicals are also saying that now our ideology is being seen by the West, and it's embarrassing the Islamic Republic.
Reza Khalili provided the video to CBN News. His book, A Time to Betray, details his years spent working as a CIA double agent inside the Iranian regime. He says despite the bad publicity around the film,
Ahmadinejad and others are defending it. And actually, there's been a public official statement from the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei's representative in the Revolutionary Guards, which verifies his position.
That position, that Khamenei is the Mahdi's deputy on earth, is gaining traction among important players in the Iranian political and religious establishments, including leaders of the powerful Revolutionary Guards Corps. One top cleric even said in this recent clip that Khamenei was no ordinary baby and that he called out the name of a Shiite holy figure when he was born. Another prominent Ayatollah, Mezbah Yazdi, is one of Iran's leading advocates of Islamic end times ideology, which says that the Mahdi will return to slaughter all non-Muslims and establish a global Islamic empire. Yazdi is also a mentor to Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, and Khalili says he's given Khamenei his apocalyptic stamp of approval.
Yazdi also stated that Khamenei ascends to the sky every year for 5 hours, meeting with Imam Mahdi. So they are defending the supreme leader's position as a saint, as a prophet, as the one who's going to pass the flag of Islam to Imam Mahdi.
Judging by their recent statements and actions, Iran's leaders believe that day is very soon. Eric Stackelbeck, CBN News, Washington.
Thanks, Eric. It's crazy. You say, this is crazy. Yeah, but when crazy people have nuclear weapons, they can do a lot of damage. And the philosophy of these people is there must be worldwide destruction before the Mahdi comes. And so Khamenei is now going up to heaven every year for 5 hours, and he consults with his Mahdi. They used to think the Mahdi was down at the bottom of a well. Now he's up in heaven. And he's talking to Khamenei and telling Khamenei, get ready to blow the world up. So you talk about satanic delusion of the first order. That's what we're dealing with here. And this is Antichrist, if I ever saw it. And the Mahdi's going to come, and Jesus is going to be at his side saying, well, you know, Muhammad is the prophet, and I'm just sort of second class. I mean, it's unbelievable what they want to establish. But this is at the highest levels of Iran. And they are framing policy on the basis of these distorted views. It is frightening, to say the least. And Wendy, I want you to know, when Khamenei got caught up to talk to the Mahdi, I didn't get caught up, did you?
This is an interview from a few years ago, but again, this is what fuels and drives Iranian government desire and passion to have nuclear weapons. They believe they have a destiny to usher in the coming of the 12th Imam or the Mahdi. They believe that this is the reason why they need the nuclear weapons. And this goes to the highest levels of government. And this video was provided by Reza Khalili, a committed Christian who was once a member of the Revolutionary Guard. So now maybe you can get a little bit of better understanding of the context and the reason why Iran is so viciously passionate for having nuclear weapons. It's their ideology, their end times ideology. Well, what we're talking about is nuclear rights instead of human rights. I want to bring this conversation to the most important thing that nations need to be discussing instead of nuclear rights, Iran's human rights instead of nuclear rights. Let's listen right now on the Cross in the Desert.
Almost 200 executions were carried out in Iran this year, 26 during the month of March alone. And last year, that figure was as high as 740. Those numbers, according to activists speaking here at the European Parliament in Strasbourg, they say the international community's silence over Iran's violation of basic human rights is deafening.
With the election last year of President Hassan Rouhani, hopes were high that Iran might be willing to make reforms in human rights alongside efforts by the United Nations and European Union to curtail Iran's nuclear development. But so far, there have been few.
The main reason I came to the European Parliament was because the nuclear talks have overshadowed the human rights situation in Iran, and people are forgetting how much human rights are being violated.
The Bohemond Foundation has observed a spike in the number of public executions since Mr. Rouhani's presidency. More than 900 political prisoners remain jailed, and women as well as religious minorities are discriminated. The Iranian regime defends its crackdown as upholding the country's traditional culture, but the Bohemond Foundation says evidence suggests otherwise.
The majority of the victims of human rights violations in Iran are Muslims, and they are practicing Muslims. I mean, Baha'is, Christians' rights are violated, but Sunni Muslims, their rights are systematically violated. Shias, their rights are violated. There are ayatollahs in prison. You have clerics who have been tortured and are now either, you know, silenced, defrocked, or outside the country. A lot of people have been killed. This is not a matter of culture. This is a classic case of an oppressive government that silenced its people.
The West has struggled to get Iran to open up about human rights. The United Nations Human Rights Envoy has been denied access, prompting EU attempts to now re-engage with Tehran in the same way it tried with President Khatami in 1997.
The leader in Iran is the one with the real power, not the president. And we had another reformist leader, President Khatami, who in the past made a lot of promises, but in the end was not able to bring about much change. And Mr. Rouhani, for the same reason, will not be able to implement a program.
European lawmakers want to keep up pressure, even suggesting the setup of a formal dialogue on human rights with Iran and an EU delegation to the country.
As the West steps up political and economic engagement with Tehran, human rights activists say this is the time to make demands. There is the sense, though, that while the focus of talks is on reducing Iran's nuclear capabilities, that human rights issues will remain dormant. Sandra Gatman for JN1 at the European Parliament in Strasbourg.
As I've said many times before, the central issue for these nations sitting down with Iran is far more important to talk about human rights rather than nuclear rights. And these are the issues that are being shuffled under the seat, if you will, that are being passed on the limb, if you will, that are not being addressed face to face. And so many of us, like myself, have to be a voice because these talks are centered around nuclear arrangements and nuclear agreements instead of the most basic fundamental thing that should be driving it is the rights of human beings, the way they are being treated, the way Iranians are suffering every day. These issues should be at the forefront in place of the nuclear rights. Well, my good friend Peymaneh, who writes so wonderfully and so insightfully and has such a good tone in all of her writings, she used to live in Iran, and she is now a Christian refugee living in Malaysia. She grew up during the revolution, and she witnessed firsthand what life was like there. I asked her to write something
about the birthday celebration, the 36th anniversary birthday celebration of the Iranian regime. And in her nice way, her sarcastic tone, she came up with this lengthy little article. And you have to understand the tone of this article. It's being sarcastic. It's prodding Iran about their big birthday celebration. So in light of that, I want you to hear what Peymaneh writes about happy birthday to the Islamic Republic of Iran. Happy birthday to you, Islamic Republic of Iran. Happy birthday to you, regime. Happy birthday to you, revolution. It is a good event for terrorists, extremists, opportunists, and mullahs for whom your birthday was a dream. How old are you? 36. It's quite a long life, but not long enough to grow so huge. Why are you so enormous? What fertilizer have you been fertilized with to grow so fast and so intensively? The way you distributed your advantages in such a big world, cancer cells cannot be distributed in human small bodies. Bravo, you are stronger than cancer, stronger than such terrible disease which has made doctors and technologists all tired. You have been very successful. Your birthday has brought many achievements that have influenced the world and will keep on influencing it for a long history. Every day is your birthday because you are making the world dance every day. You are holding a birthday party every day. Each day you have new music for your nation. Each day you have a new joke to make the world laugh. You have fireworks and magic tricks every day. You have puppet shows every day. You have parades and street carnivals every day. You are singing a new song every day. You are treating the world to your great amusement. You have new events born every day. Look at the candles in your cake. The first one you lit up 36 years ago is still burning. Its flame is not only burning itself, but burning the country and shining some parts of the world. They are not candles, but hyperion. The flame is not going to reach the bottom. 36 candles of this type are enough to burn a country. And it's lava, like the lava of a volcano, reaching other countries too. Yeah, you are generous enough to offer some beautiful, shiny, hot lava to other countries too. I am right, volcano. Your birthday cake is like a volcano, an active volcano. It is always active. It became more active when you made the first piece of the yellow cake. Now, quote, what Peymaneh is referring to, yellow cake, is really kind of a word about the uranium powder that's used in making a nuclear bomb. So the yellow cake is symbolistic of that, so that you understand. Yellow cake, what a great achievement it was for Iranians. It was such a blessing that the world got jealous of Iran and its improvements, so they opposed you and started sanctions. Still, you were so nice that you did not want anybody around the world to mess up such a blessing. You were eager to bless Israel by this yellow cake. By force, of course. Oh, sorry, I made a mistake. You were eager to bless the world, wiping Israel out from the map on the earth by this yellow cake. You are nice enough to take such a burden for Islam and the world to help them get rid of Israel. You are nice enough. Your yellow cake brought nuclear energy, but dissipated the nation's energy. Your cake is not sweet at all because you know sweet things may harm the health. So you have to be careful not to hurt your dear people. You value their life and health so much. This is why you made the cake bitter. Although the initial promise for such a birthday was a very sweet cake, too sweet to fulfill, you made the cake with something very clean and nutritious, with pure blood. Pure blood of brave people, strong people, with the bones you broke in prison and the hearts you hurt and the bodies you injured. Your birthday songs are down with this country, down with this nation, a very different song. Your birthday magic trick, well, it's unique too. Not a coin, but all the wealth of the country disappears suddenly and found in the pockets of mullahs, here and there in personal bank accounts of officials overseas. The magician is not a magician, but he's also a puppet show for the guests. The puppets whom he moves any way he desires and puts any word he wants in their mouth, he moves all the puppets of presidents, ministers, mullahs, any puppet. What a birthday. Everything is perfect. There is fireworks, too. Fireworks. Bang, bang in this prison. Bang, bang in that jail. Bang, bang in the street. Bang, bang. Bullets. Bang, bang. Bombs. The bullets targeting their hearts. The bullets targeting heads. the bombs targeting lives, civilian lives, children's lives. Your birthday is so sumptuous. Every day there's a parade, such a big parade that thousands of people go to the street and sing the songs of hate and enmity for you. Thousands of men with beard and women in black chadors. They are so lucky they are controlled by the crowded masses and do not fall as they only show their nose and may not see their front as well. You treat all the world for your birthday. Everybody has a special portion from such a good birthday. The nations are treated by the blessings of Islam, spirituality, good deeds, worshiping angels. Terrorists are treated by providing them with ammunition and money. Palestine and Lebanon, financial support, Iraq, gold, Venezuela, and others have their own portion too. But the portion of U.S., Canada, and Europe, and many other countries is Iranian refugees. Dear leader, Mr. Khamenei, dear mullahs, dear government, no matter if we are lacking energy, do not give up your plans of nuclear energy. That is more important, of course. No matter if the world imposes a sanction, no matter if the sanctions bring death for cancer patients, MS patients, special patients, even if we die, it's for Islam. So we go to paradise and receive a reward. No matter if the sanctions bring us hunger, we can fast. This way we can overcome our temptations and exercise our spirits. This way we can understand the hunger of poor people. No matter if oil is cheaper than mineral water, we are not going to drink oil. No matter if our currency is low, we must learn to be independent. We must learn to economize. No matter if nothing is left for us, we still have Islam. No matter if students cannot afford education, Islam does not need educated people. Islam needs real soldiers. No matter if the rivers and lakes are getting dry, Imam Hussein, Shia's Imam, and his children were more thirsty in the Karbala War. No matter if the achievements of the revolution is living below the poverty line, the biggest achievement is Islam. The leader of the Muslims in the world and his supporters must have a comfortable life. Fortunately, they do. Thank God for that. No matter if the nations are dying because of air pollution, cancer, tsunamis, and are buried under the soil, dust, and Kurdistan, people are not human beings. Only mullahs and their friends are. People's lives are not important. Islam is important. Dear Mr. Revolution, you have been celebrating many birthdays, but it will not be long lasting. Every birthday has an end. Yours will, too. Wow. Peymaneh, my gifted Iranian Christian refugee, in her sarcastic tone, making a point on happy birthday to the Islamic Republic of Iran. What I want to do, I want to dedicate this next song to those very courageous 21 Egyptian Coptic Christians who stayed faithful to their testimony for Jesus and gave their lives as martyrs and were the victims of this recent beheading. We have a creed as Christians that we stand firm on, that we do not surrender, no compromise. And this is a song by the Newsboys called We Believe that really kind of pictures what happened to these 21 Coptic Christians. They held fast to their creed. And in the end, they will rule and reign with Christ. Let's listen to this song right now, On the Cross in the Desert.
In this time of desperation, when all we know is doubt and fear, only one foundation. We believe. We believe. We believe in God the Father. We believe in Jesus Christ. We believe in the Holy Spirit, and He's given us new life. We believe in the crucifixion. We believe that He conquered death. We believe in the resurrection, and He's coming back again. We believe. So let our faith be more than anthems. darkness and temptations. We believe. We believe. We believe in God the Father. We believe in Jesus Christ. We believe in the Holy Spirit, and He's given us new life. We believe in the crucifixion. We believe that He conquered death. We believe in the resurrection, and He's coming back again. Let the light. Father, we believe in Jesus Christ. We believe in the Holy Spirit, and He's given us new life. We believe in the crucifixion. We believe that He conquered death. We believe in the resurrection, and He's coming back. He's coming back again.
Music of the Newsboys from their latest CD, and it's called We Believe. I deliberately chose that song simply because there's that creed we as Christians hold fast to, that uncompromising creed that in the case of these Egyptian Coptic Christians, because they held fast to their creed, to their faith in Christ, it cost them their lives. But they are ruling and reigning with Christ even now as I speak. And I'm thinking what Jesus taught us, speaking about His return and the great tribulation coming in Luke chapter 21. He says, "You will be dragged into synagogues and prisons, and you will stand trial before kings and governors because you are my followers. But this will be your opportunity to tell them about me. So don't worry in advance about how to answer the charges against you, for I will give you the right words and such wisdom that none of your opponents will be able to reply or refute you. Even those closest to you, your parents, brothers, relatives, and friends, will betray you. They will even kill some of you, and everyone will hate you because you are my followers. But not a hair of your head will perish. By standing firm, you will win your souls." And this is what Jesus is teaching to a question the disciples have asked Him. It's recorded in Matthew and Mark as well. What will be the sign of your coming and the end? And in Luke, He talks about the destruction of Jerusalem, which happened in AD 70. And He's preparing them for what's about to happen in a few years after His death and resurrection. But this also applies not only to the first century church and to the Jewish people and the destruction of Jerusalem. It certainly applies, first of all, to us as Christians living in this age. We are the church. And so Jesus' words are very instructive to us. They transcend the time that He spoke them to the disciples to what we are living in right now. And although the context is the fall of Jerusalem, He's also talking about a great tribulation that will come. That has not come yet. But notice what He says to us. You are going to be brought before kings and governors. You're going to be persecuted. Even some in your family will kill you because you are my followers. It's instructive to me how we share our faith or tell the story of the Christian faith to those that are not Christians. Do we tell them that if you become a follower of Jesus, It's possible you could be killed. Do we tell them what it means to follow Jesus? And we tell them about the health, wealth, benefits, most of us. But do we tell them the truth about what it means to really follow after Jesus? How we will be hated? And this is the case when you think of the 21 Coptic Christians. I'm sure when they became Christians, they were immediately aware in the context of where they live what it meant for them to say no to Islam and yes to Jesus, to say no to Muhammad and yes to Christ. They understood the cost of following Jesus. And they stood firm to the end, not compromising. What a witness that is to you and me. To the four Iraqi children, last year I read about, that when they were told by ISIS, either you denounce your Christian faith and return to Islam or we're going to behead you. And they said, no, we can't do that. We love Yeshua. We are seeing Christianity, true Christianity, lived right before our eyes. We are going to be called upon one day as Christians to give a testimony of what we believe, and we may pay with our lives because of it. And so when we look at what's happening in the Middle East, we see what's happening to the Egyptian Coptic Christians, to the Iraqi children. It gives us a wake-up call. We are living in luxury, and we are living in comfortability. And really the test of us, if we're really true Christians, if what happens when we're called to give our lives for Christ, what will we say? Will we back down? Will we stand firm? What will we do? And Jesus says this will be the lot of everyone that follows him. They're going to be hated. And so today I would ask you, think of our Christian brothers and sisters in the Middle East who are suffering firsthand for their faith, and pray for them. Pray for them to be strong and uncompromising. And pray for ourselves to live a life of courage like they are living, that we too will not back down. We will not give in. We will stand firm and be a witness for Jesus, even if it cost us our lives. And it just is a wake-up call to me. As I sit here behind my computer, where I could be in a prison waiting to die. Will I be faithful? Will I stand firm to the end? It is a wake-up call to yours truly as well. And so let's continue to pray for our brothers and sisters in the Middle East. Let's continue to pray for Iranians as they suffer as well. If you want to be my friend, come to my Facebook page. You're going to see many, many postings about human rights issues and those that are suffering in Iran. I really encourage you to come to my Facebook page and really join me in being a voice of hope and freedom to them as well. I really appreciate you taking the time to spend it with me today, to listen to the issues, to stand with me, to pray with me, to be a voice with me to those suffering in the Middle East and in Iran. I want to thank you, Mary, especially coming into the chat room today and talking with me. Thank you, dear Mary, what a committed Christian and a committed listener to my program. Thank you, and God bless you. I will see you soon again on the next Cross in the Desert. Have yourself an incredible week. God bless you. We're going to take it out with Michael W. Smith now and Healing Rain.
Healing rain is coming down.